This is Audible.
Hachette Audio presents Today Will Be Different, written by Maria Semple, read by Kathleen Wilhoit. Includes a Mac and PC compatible PDF of illustrations by Patrick Semple, Poppy Mayer, and Eric Chase Anderson. For George and Poppy, and to a lesser extent, Ralphie. Today will be different. Today I will be present. Today, anyone I speak to, I will look them in the eye and listen deeply. Today I'll play a board game with Timby. I'll initiate sex with Joe. Today I will take pride in my appearance. I'll shower, get dressed in proper clothes, and change into yoga clothes only for yoga, which today I will actually attend. Today I won't swear. I won't talk about money. Today there will be an ease about me. My face will be relaxed, its resting place a smile. Today I will radiate calm. Kindness and self-control will abound. Today I will buy local. Today I will be my best self, the person I am capable of being. Today will be different. The trick. Because the other way wasn't working, the waking up just to get the day over with until it's time for bed, the grinding it out was a disgrace, an affront to the honor and long shot of being alive at all, the ghost walking, the short-tempered distraction, the hurried fog, all of this I'm just assuming because I have no idea how I come across. My consciousness is that underground like a toad in winter. The leaving the world a worse place just by being in it. The blindness to the destruction in my wake. The Mr. Magoo. If I'm forced to be honest, here's an account of how I left the world last week. Worse, worse, better, worse, same, worse, same. Not an inventory to make one swell with pride. I don't necessarily need to make the world a better place. Mind you, today I will live by the Hippocratic Oath. First, do no harm. How hard can it be? Dropping off Timby, having my poetry lesson, my favorite part of life, taking a yoga class, eating lunch with Sydney Madsen, whom I can't stand, but at least I can check her off the list. More on that later. Picking up Timby and giving back to Joe, the underwriter of all this mad abundance. You're trying to figure out why the agita surrounding one normal day of white people problems? Because there's me, and there's the beast in me. It'd be kind of brilliant if the beast in me played out on a giant canvas, shocking and awing, causing fabulous destruction, talked about forever. If I could swing that, I just might self-immolate gloriously for the performance art spectacle. The sad truth? The beast in me plays out on a painfully small scale. Regrettable microtransactions, usually involving Timby, my friends, or Joe. I'm irritable and consumed by anxiety when I'm with them. Maudlin and shit-talking when I'm not. Ha! Aren't you glad you're a safe distance, doors locked, windows rolled up? Ah, come on. I'm nice. I'm exaggerating for effect. It's not really like that. And so the day began, the minute I whipped off my sheets. The click-click-click of Yo-Yo's nails across the hardwood, stopping outside the bedroom. Why, when Joe whips off his sheets, doesn't Yo-Yo trot, 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 and wait in abject hope? How can Yo-Yo, on the other side of a closed door, tell it's me and not Joe? It was once depressingly explained by a dog trainer. It's my smell Yo-Yo's caught whiff of. That his idea of nirvana is a dead seal washed up on the beach leaves me asking, is it time for bed yet? Nope, I'm not doing that. Not today. I didn't mean to be coy about Sydney Madsen. When Joe and I arrived in Seattle from New York 10 years ago, we were ready to start a family. I'd just wrapped 5 wearying years of Looper Wash, Everywhere you looked, it was Looper Wash t-shirts, bumper stickers, mouse pads. I'm a Vivian. I'm a Dot. You remember. If not, check your nearest dollar store, the 2-for-1 bin. It's been a while. Joe, a hand surgeon, had become a legend of sorts for reconstructing the hand of that quarterback whose thumb bent back and nobody thought he'd ever play again, but the next year he went on to win the Super Bowl. Now, I can't remember his name, but even if I did, I couldn't say due to doctor-patient-nosy-wife confidentiality. Joe had job offers everywhere. Why pick Seattle? Joe, a nice Catholic boy from outside Buffalo, couldn't see raising kids in Manhattan, my first choice. We struck a deal. We'd move anywhere he wanted for 10 years and back to New York for 10. His city for 10, my city for 10. Back and forth unto death. A deal he's conveniently forgotten his end of, I might add, seeing as we're coming up on year 10 and not a peep on packing up. As everybody knows, being raised Catholic with half a brain means becoming an atheist. At one of our skeptics conventions, yes, our early years were actually spent doing things like driving to Philadelphia to watch Penn Jillette debate a rabbi. Oh, to be childless again. Or not. Joe heard that Seattle was the least religious city in America. Seattle, it was. A Doctors Without Borders board member threw Joe and me a welcome-to-town party. I swanned into her Lake Washington mansion filled with modern art and future friends, mine for the taking. My whole life, I've been liked. Okay, I'll say it. I've been adored. I don't understand why, on account of my disgraceful personality, but somehow it works. Joe says it's because I'm the most guy-like woman he's ever met, but sexy and with no emotional memory. A compliment. I went from room to room being introduced to a series of women, interchangeable in their decency and warmth. It was that thing where you meet somebody who tells you they like camping and you say, oh, I was just talking to someone who was going on a 10-day rafting trip down the Snake River. You should totally meet them. And the person says, that was me. What can I say? I'm terrible with faces and names and numbers and times and dates. The whole party was a blur, with one woman eager to show me funky shops, another hidden hikes, another Mario Batali's father's Italian restaurant in Pioneer Square, another the best dentist in town who has a glitter painting on his ceiling of a parachuting tiger, yet another willing to share her housekeeper. One of them, Sydney Madsen, invited me to lunch the next day at the Tamarind Tree in the International District. Joe has a thing he calls the magazine test. It's the reaction you have when you open the mailbox and you pull out a magazine. Instantly you know if you're happy to see this magazine or bummed. Which is why I don't subscribe to The New Yorker and do subscribe to Us Weekly. Put to the magazine test, Sydney Madsen is the human equivalent of tinnitus today. That first lunch, she was so careful with her words. So sincere in her gaze, noticed a small spot on her fork and was overly solicitous toward the waiter when asking for a new one. Brought her own tea bag and asked for hot water. Said she wasn't very hungry, so how about we split my green papaya salad? Told me she'd never seen Looper Wash, but would put a hold on the DVDs at the library. Am I painting a clear enough picture of the tight-assed dreariness, the selfish cluelessness, the cheap creepiness? A water-stained fork never killed anybody. Buy the DVDs. How about that? Eat the food at the restaurant. That's how they stay in business. Worst of all, Sydney Madsen was steady, earnest, without a speck of humor, and talked very slowly as if her platitudes were little gold coins. I was in shock. Living too long in New York does that to a girl. Gives her the false sense that the world is full of interesting people. Or at least people who are crazy in an interesting way. At one point, I writhed so violently in my chair that Sydney actually asked, "Do you need to use the powder room?" Powder room? Powder room? Kill her! The worst part? all those women with whom I gladly agree to go hiking and shopping, they weren't a bunch of women. They were all Sydney Madsen. Damn that blur! It took everything I had to kink her fire hose of new invitations. A weekend at her beach house on Vashon Island, introducing me to the wife of someone for this, the playwright as something for that. I ran home screaming to Joe. Joe, you should have been suspicious of someone so eager to make friends, because it probably means she doesn't have any. Me, this is why I love you, Joe. You just boil it all down. Joe the Boiler. Don't we just love him? Forgive me for long-hauling you on Sydney Madsen. My point is, for 10 years, I haven't been able to shake her. She's the friend I don't like. The friend I don't know what she does for a living because I was too stultified to ask the first time and would be rude to ask now because I'm not rude. The friend I can't be mean enough to so she gets the message because I'm not mean. The friend to whom I keep saying, no, 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 and yet she still chases me. She's like Parkinson's. You can't cure her. You can just manage the symptoms. For today, the lunch bell tolls. Please know I'm aware that lunch with a boring person is a boutique problem. When I say I have problems, I'm not talking about Sydney Madsen. Yo-Yo trotting down the street, the prince of Belltown. Oh, Yo-Yo, you foolish creature with your pep and your blind devotion, your busted ear flapping with every prance. How poignant it is, the pride you take in being walked by me, your immortal beloved. If only you knew. What a disheartening spectacle it's been. A new month, a new condo higher than the last, each packed with blue-badged Amazon squids, every morning squirting by the thousands from their studio apartments onto my block, heads and devices never looking up. They work for Amazon, so you know they're soulless. The only question, how soulless? It makes me pine for the days when Third Avenue was just me, empty storefronts, and the one tweaker yelling, "That's how you spell America!" Outside our building, Dennis stood by his wheelie trash can and refilled the poop bag dispenser. "Good morning, you two." "Good morning, Dennis." Instead of my usual breezing past, I stopped and looked him in the eye. "How's your day so far?" "Oh, I can't complain," he said. "You?" "Can complain, but won't," Dennis chuckled. "Today, already a net gain." I opened the front door of our apartment. At the end of the hallway, Joe, face down at the table, his forehead flat on the newspaper, arms splayed with bent elbows as if under arrest. It was a jarring image, one of pure defeat, the last thing I'd ever associate with Joe. Thunk. The door shut. I unclipped Yo-Yo's harness. By the time I straightened, my stricken husband had gotten up and disappeared into his office. Whatever it was, he didn't want to talk about it. My attitude? Works for me. Yo-Yo raced to his food, greyhound style, back legs vaulting past his front. Realizing it was the same dry food that had been there before his walk, he became overwhelmed with confusion and betrayal. He took one step and stared at a spot on the floor. Timby's light clicked on. God bless him, up before the alarm. I went into his bathroom and found him on the step stool in his PJs. "Morning, darling. Look at you up and awake." He stopped what he was doing. "Can we have bacon?" Timby in the mirror waited for me to leave. I lowered my eyes. The little quick-draw McGraw beat my glance. He pushed something into the sink before I could see it. The unmistakable clang of lightweight plastic. The Sephora 200. It was nobody's fault but my own. Santa putting a makeup kit in Timby's stocking. It's how I'd buy myself extra time at Nordstrom, telling Timby to roam cosmetics. The girls there loved his gentle nature, his sugar sack body, his squeaky voice. Soon enough, they were making him up. I don't know if he liked the makeup as much as he liked being doted on by a gaggle of blondes. On a lark, I picked up a kit the size of a paperback that unfolded and fanned out to reveal 6 different makeup trays holding 200 shadows, glosses, blushes, and whatever they were. The person who'd found their way to cram so much into so little should seriously be working for NASA, if they still have that. You do realize you're not wearing makeup to school, I told him. I know, Mom. The sigh and shoulder heave right out of the Disney Channel. Again, my bad for letting it take root. After school, a jigsaw puzzle. I emerged from Timby's room. Yo-Yo, standing anxiously, shivered with relief upon seeing that I still existed. Knowing I'd be heading to the kitchen to make breakfast, he raced me to his food bowl. This time, he deigned to eat some, one eye on me. Joe was back and making himself tea. "How's things?" I asked. "Don't you look nice?" he said. True to my grand scheme for the day, I'd showered and put on a dress and oxfords. If you beheld my closet, you'd see a woman of specific style. Dresses from France and Belgium, price tags ripped off before I got home because Joe would have an aneurysm, and every iteration of flat black shoe. Again, no need to discuss price. Buy them? Yes. Put them on? On most days, too much energy. Olivia's coming tonight, I said with a wink, already tasting the wine flight and the rigatoni a tavolata. How about she takes Timby out so we can have a little alone time? Joe grabbed me by the waist and pulled me in as if we weren't a couple of 50-year-olds. Here's who I envy. Lesbians. Why? Lesbian bed death. Apparently, after a lesbian couple's initial flush of hot sex, they stop having it all together. It makes perfect sense. Left to their own devices, women would stop having sex after they have children. There's no evolutionary need for it. Our brain knows it. Our body knows it. Who feels sexy during the slog of motherhood, the middle-aged fat roll and the flattening butt? What woman wants anyone to see her naked, let alone fondle her breasts squishy now like bags of cake batter, or touch her stomach spongy like breadfruit? Who wants to pretend they're all sexed up when the honey pot is dry? Me, that's who, if I don't want to get switched out for a younger specimen. Alone time it is, I said to Joe. Mom, this broke. Timby came in with his ukulele and plonked it down on the counter, suspiciously near the trash. The sound's all messed up. What do you propose we do? I asked, daring him to say, buy a new one. Joe picked up the ukulele and strummed. It's a little out of tune, that's all. He began to adjust the strings. Hey, I said, since when can you tune a ukulele? I'm a man of many mysteries, Joe said, and gave the instrument a final dulcet strum. The bacon and French toast were being wolfed, the smoothies being drunk. Timby was deep into an Archie double digest. My smile was on lockdown. 2 years ago, when I was getting all martyry about having to make breakfast every morning, Joe said, I pay for this circus. Can you please climb down off your cross and make breakfast without the constant sighing? I know what you're going to say. What a jerk. What a sexist thug. But Joe had a point. Lots of women would gladly do worse for a closet full of Antwerp. From that point forward, it was service with a smile. It's called knowing when you've got a weak hand. Joe showed Timby the newspaper. The pinball expo is coming back to town. Wanna go?
Do you think the Evel Knievel machine will break again?
Almost certainly, Joe said. I handed over the poem I'd printed out and heavily annotated. Okay, who's going to help me? I asked. Timby didn't look up from his Archie. Joe took it. Ooh, Robert Lowell. I began from memory. Nautical Island's hermit heiress still lives through winter in her Spartan cottage. Her sheep still graze above the sea. Her son's a bishop. Her farmer's first selectman.
Her farmer is first selectman, Joe said.
Shoot, her farmer is first selectman.
Mom?
I shushed Timby and continued on with eyes closed. In our village, she's in her dotage, thirsting for the hierarchic privacy
of Queen Victoria's century, she buys up all the eyesores facing her shore and lets them fall the season's ill. We've lost our summer millionaire who seemed to leap from an L.L. Bean catalog.
Mommy, look at Yo-Yo. See how his chin is sitting on his paws?
Yo-Yo was positioned on his pink lozenge so he could watch for dropped food, his little light paws delicately crossed.
Aw,
I said.
Can I have your phone? Timmy asked.
Just enjoy your pet, I said. This doesn't have to turn into electronics.
It's very cool what Mom is doing, Joe said to Timmy. Always learning.
Learning and forgetting, I said, but thank you. He shot me an air kiss. I pressed onward.
His nine-knot yawl was auctioned off to lobstermen.
Don't we love Yo-Yo? Timby asked.
We do, the simple truth. Yo-Yo is the world's cutest dog. Part Boston Terrier, part pug, part something else. Brindle and white with a black patch on one eye. Bat ears, smooshed face, and curly-cue tail. Before the Amazon invasion, when it was just me and hookers on the street, one remarked, it's like if Barbie had a pit bull.
Daddy, Timby said, don't you love Yo-Yo?
Joe looked at Yo-Yo and considered the question, more evidence of Joe's superiority. He thinks before he speaks.
He's a little weird, Joe said and returned to the poem.
Timby dropped his fork. I dropped my jaw.
Weird?
Timby cried. Joe looked up.
Yeah, what?
Oh, Daddy, how could you say that?
He just sits there all day looking depressed, Joe said. When we come home, he doesn't greet us at the door. When we are here, he just sleeps, waits for food to drop, or stares at the front door like he has a migraine.
For Timby and me, there were simply no words.
I know what he's getting out of us, Joe said. I just don't know what we're getting out of him. Timby jumped out of his chair and lay across Yo-Yo, his version of a hug.
Oh, Yo-Yo, I love you.
Keep going, Joe flicked the poem. You're doing great. The season's ill.
The season's ill, I said.
We've lost our summer millionaire who seemed to leap from an L.L. Bean catalog. To Timby, you get ready.
Are we driving through or are you walking me in?
Driving. I have Alonzo at 8:30. Our breakfast over. Yo-Yo got up from his pillow. Joe and I watched as he walked to the front door and stared at it.
I didn't realize I was being controversial, Joe said. The season's ill.
It's easy to tell who went to Catholic school by how they react when they drive up Queen Anne Hill and behold the Gaylor Street School. I didn't, so to me, it's a stately brick building with a huge flat yard and improbably dynamite view of the Puget Sound. Joe did, so he goes white with flashbacks of nuns whacking his hands with rulers, priests threatening him with God's wrath, and spectacle-snatching bullies roaming the halls unchecked. By the time we pulled into drop-off, I recited the poem twice perfectly and was doing it a third time for charm. One dark night, my Tudor Ford climbed the hill's skull. Wait, is that right? Ominous silence from the back seat.
Hey,
I said, are you even following along?
I am, Mom. You're doing perfect.
Perfectly. Adverbs end in L-Y. Timby wasn't in the rearview mirror. I figurated to see him hunched over something.
What are you doing?
Nothing. Followed again by that high-pitched rattle of plastic.
Hey, no makeup!
Then why did Santa put it in my stocking?
I turned around, but Timby's door had opened and shut. By the time I swung back, he was bounding up the front steps. In reflection of the front door, I caught Timby's eyelids smeared with rouge. I rolled down my window.
You little sneak, get back here!
The car behind me honked. Ah, well. He was school's problem now. Me peeling out of Gaylor Street with 7 child-free hours on the horizon? Cue the banjo getaway music.
I myself am hell. Nobody's here. Only skunks that search in moonlight for a bite to eat. They march on their souls up Main Street,
white stripes, moonstruck eyes, red fire under the chalk dry and sparse spire of the Trinitarian Church. I stand on top of our back steps and breathe the rich air. A mother skunk with her column of kittens swills the garbage pail. She jabs her wedge head in a cup of sour cream, drops her ostrich tail, and will not scare.
I nailed it syllable for syllable.
Alonzo stuck out his hand. Congratulations. You know how your brain turns to mush? How it starts when you're pregnant? You'll laugh full of wonder and conspiracy, and you'll chide yourself. Me and my pregnant brain. Then you give birth and your brain doesn't return. But you're breastfeeding, so you laugh as if you're a member of an exclusive club. Me and my nursing brain. Then you stop nursing, and the terrible truth descends. Your good brain is never coming back. You've traded vocabulary, lucidity, and memory for motherhood. You know how you're in the middle of a sentence, and you realize at the end you're going to need to call up a certain word, and you're worried you won't be able to, but you're already committed, so you hurtle along, and then you pause because you've arrived at the end, but the word hasn't. And it's not even a $10 word you're after, like polemic or shibboleth, but a $2 word, like distinctive, so you just end up saying amazing. Which is how you join the gang of nitwits who described everything as amazing. Well, it rattled the hell out of me. I had a memoir to write. Yes, much of my memoir was going to be illustrations. No problem there. The words were the rub. With a book, I couldn't just blather on in my accustomed way. Economy was everything. An economy wasn't happening due to the above-mentioned bad brain. I got the big idea to sharpen my instrument by memorizing poems. My mother was an actress. She used to recite Shakespeare soliloquies before bed. It was amazing. There, amazing. If my brain weren't so bad, I might have said, it was proof she was disciplined and properly educated and may have had an inkling of her terrible fate. So I did what anyone would do. I picked up the phone, called the University of Washington, and asked for their finest poetry teacher. For the past year, I've been meeting Alonzo Wren every Thursday morning at Lola for private lessons. He assigns me a poem, I recite it from memory, and the conversation gallops where it may. I pay him $50 plus breakfast. Alonzo would buy me breakfast, so great is his love of poetry, but my will is stronger, so he accepts it, and the crisp bill with a poet's grace. What did you think? Alonzo asked. He's a big guy, younger than me, with a mop of mouse-colored hair atop his exceedingly kind face. He always wore a suit, linen in the summer, wool in the winter. Today's was chocolate with a sheen. Must have been vintage. And under it, a shirt the color of parchment. His tie was moiré, his pocket square starched white. Joe's mother made him wear a suit and tie to the dentist to show respect for the profession. Little Joe wearing a tie in the dentist's chair equals falling in love all over. Can we start with what's concretely happening in the poem? I asked Alonzo. What's the term for that? The discreet incident? The discriminated occasion. The discriminated occasion, I said. You'd better make that the title of your autobiography. I might prefer discreet incident. I unfolded my marked-up poem and launched in. It starts with the hermit heiress who lives year-round on the summer island. I'm picturing Maine. Alonzo nodded, seating it as a possibility. Her farmer, I said. Is that her husband? More like someone in her employ who farms her land. Like you're my poet, I said. Like I'm your poet. There's lots of oranges, I said, but red, too. Blue Hill is turning fox red. The red comes back later with the blood cells and the skunk's eyes. God, doesn't your heart break for the fairy decorator? Don't you just want to go buy something in his shop? Don't you want to just fix him up with the hermit heiress? Now that you mention it, Alonzo said with a laugh. Then the poet steps out of the shadows. He's been saying our up until now. But then it turns to I. Is he called the poet or the narrator? The narrator, Alonzo said. The narrator appears. It's a real shock when the poem Alligator Tales around and says, my mind's not right.
What do you know about Robert Lowell?
Alonzo asked.
Only what you're about to tell me.
Our food arrived. Alonzo always ordered Tom's Big Breakfast. It comes with octopus and bacon. I always ordered the daily egg white scramble with fruit. God, I depressed myself.
Can I have your bacon? I said.
Robert Lowell was born to Boston Brahmins, Alonzo said, placing the thick strips on a saucer. He battled mental illness his whole life and was in and out of institutions.
Oh, I suddenly had an idea. I waved over the waitress.
You know how you sell cookies and mints and that garlic spread? Can you make me a gift basket?
For Sydney Madsen, another bugbear was the way she always arrived with little presents for me. Today being different, I would bring her one too.
Alonzo continued. The poet John Berryman suggests that Skunk Hour depicts the moment when the eye of the poem...
The eye of the poem? I had to laugh. You're among friends. Just say Robert Lowell.
When Robert Lowell recognizes a depression is coming on that will leave him hospitalized. A catatonic vision of frozen terror, Berryman called this poem. I, myself, am hell. Nobody's here. Only skunks, I said. Something occurred to me. Only. Another one of our poems hinged on the word only.
Alonzo frowned.
Dover Beach!
I practically shouted because how on earth did I remember that when I can't remember what year it is?
Come to the window, sweet is the night air, only from the long line of spray.
That's when that poem turns on its axis, too. Alonzo pointed to my printout.
May I?
Go ahead. He tore off a corner and wrote only.
Look at me, making the page, I said. Will you use that in one of your poems?
Alonzo cocked an eyebrow mysteriously and pulled out his wallet, bursting with similar scraps. Among the stacked credit cards, a blue stripe with white blocked letters.
Hey, I said before I could think it through. Why do you have a Louisiana driver's license?
It's where I grew up. Alonzo handed over a long-haired version of himself.
New Orleans.
With those two words, the sucker punch.
Are you okay? Alonzo asked.
I've never been to Louisiana, were the words that came out. A bizarre non-answer and a lie.
Now I needed to say something true.
I have no connection to New Orleans.
Just hearing myself speak the name made me drop my fork into my breakfast. The waitress bounced up with a gift basket the size of a car seat.
Someone's gonna be happy today. Seeing my face, she added quickly,
or not.
We good here?
I'm good, Alonzo said.
I'm good.
To prove my point, I lifted my fork out of my eggs and gave the handle a defiant lick. The waitress pivoted on her heel and scrammed.
A question, I said, fumbling for the poem.
I needed to get this morning back on track.
Spar spire. Would that be the steeple?
A spar is a ship's mast, Alonzo said, so probably. My phone jumped to life. Gaylor Street School.
There is no way, I said.
Is this Eleanor?
It's Lila from Gaylor Street. Everything's fine, it's just Timby seems to have a tummy ache. 3 times in the past 2 weeks I've had to pick him up early. 3 times there was nothing wrong.
Does he have a fever? I asked.
No, but he's looking awfully miserable lying here in the office.
Please tell him to cut it out and go back to class.
Ooh, Lila said, but if he is sick...
That's what I'm telling you. There's no arguing. Okay, I'll be right there. I slid out of the booth.
That kid, I'll show him fear and a handful of dust.
I bade adieu to Alonzo, grabbed the gift basket, and split. As I opened the door, I glanced back. Alonzo, bless him, seemed more disconsolate than I that our poetry lesson had come to such an abrupt end. I walked up the steps between the thickest columns and into the impressive foyer of the Gaylor Street School. It was underlit and cathedral cool. Framed photos told the story of the building's transformation from a home for wayward girls to a single-family residence. to today's ruinously expensive private school. A little about the building's restoration. On the floor in wood inlay, because straight is the gate and narrow is the path which leadeth unto life and few there be that find it, dated to 1906. 150 rubber molds were created for the intricate plaster work. Colorado alabaster was cut paper thin for the clerestory. The mosaic of Christ teaching children to pray required flying in a 70-year-old craftsman from Ravenna, Italy. When the restoration began in 2012, the big mystery was what happened to the brass Art Deco chandelier from the early photos. It was found by the guys blowtorching blackberry vines out of the basement. Large blindfolded pigs were lowered in on ropes to chew the chandelier free. How could I possibly know this? As I entered, the chic architect in charge of the restoration happened to be leading a tour. On my way to the administration offices, Eleanor! I turned. For the past month, the conference room had become auction central, abuzz with parent volunteers. You're just the person we need, said the woman, a young mom. Me? I mouthed, pointing confused. Yes, you, said another young mom, as if I were a silly goose. We have a question. When I graduated from college, it never would have occurred to me not to work. That's why women went to college, to get jobs. Get jobs we did, and kicked some serious ass while we were at it, thank you very much, until we realized we'd lost track of time and madly scrambled to get pregnant. I pushed it dangerously close to the wire, no doubt because Catholic Joe, the oldest of seven, was in no hurry himself, having changed enough diapers for a lifetime. I gave birth to little Timby, thus joining the epidemic of haggard women in their 40s trapped in playgrounds, slumped on boingy ladybugs, unconsciously pouring Tupperware containers of Cheerios down their own throats, donning maternity jeans 2 years after giving birth, and sporting skunk stripes down the center of their hair as they pushed swings. Who needed to look good anymore? We got the kid. Was the sight of us so terrifying that the entire next generation of college-educated women declared, "Anything but that!" and forsook careers altogether to pop out children in their 20s? Looking at the Gaylor Street moms, the answer would be, apparently. I hope it works out for them. I entered the conference room with its giant beveled windows overlooking the play yard and Elliott Bay. A massive table cut from the center of a maple tree salvaged from the property of some such trendy nonsense, according to the architect, was piled with file boxes and cascading manila folders. I weaved my way through the hip-height cardboard cartons with Gaylor Street T-shirts hanging out, red like tongues. The air crackled with efficiency and purpose. "Where are you? Where are you? Where are you?" the young mom muttered. "Here," I said. "You need to find the item number and cross-reference it with her name," said another young mom. I went to Japan once, and our guide claimed that to them, all Americans looked alike. At the time, I thought, oh, you're just saying that about us because that's what we say about you. But beholding this array of young, glowing, physically fit moms, it occurred to me that Fumiko might not have been messing with me after all. "Got ridiculous?" said the first young mom. A young dad, because there's always one dad, held up a folder. "Victory is mine." "You won a latte, you won a latte," sing-song the first or the second or the third or the fourth mom. Put these parents in a room with clerical work and zero supervision, and they start acting like the deranged winners in an Indian casino ad. "You donated a hand-drawn portrait of the winning bidder in the style of Looper Wash," said one, finally acknowledging my existence. "That's you?" asked another. Like ostriches, they all stopped and cocked their heads at me. "I heard you went there," said one, taking me in. "Timmy's mom," said another, the expert. "Seattle is short on star power. A Pastor Prime animator and a Seahawks doctor make me and Joe the Gaylor Street's equivalent of Posh and Bex." "I'm a Vivian," said one. "You're totally a Fern," corrected another. "What are you doing now?" one flat out asked me.
I'm writing a memoir, I said, heat weirdly building in my cheeks.
A graphic memoir.
It was none of their business, but I kept going. I have an advance from a publisher and everything. The ostriches smiled inscrutably. On the table, a ring of keys. Each key had one of those color-coded rubber jobs around the top. In my life, I'd bought 100 of the damn things, but had always given up because who can put them on without bending a nail? Also, on the ring, a neat fan of barcode tags from Breathe Hot Yoga, Corps de Ballet Spin Cycle, and, in a personal touch, this young, fit mom had attached a lanyard with her child's name in baby blocks. I turned my head sideways. What was the name? D-E-L-P-H-I-N-E. I froze. Yoo-hoo! Called a young mom. You forgot to put a dollar value as to what it's worth, said another. What's worth? I said, snapping to. Your auction item, put in another. For tax purposes. Oh, I don't know. We need to put down something, said the first young mom. It's just a few hours of my time. My breath had become stuck. Why did I have to see those goddamn keys? What's your time worth? This was the young dad, resting control. Literally, I said, per hour? Did he mean the hours I spent lying in bed vowing to change? The hours shopping for organizers that forever remained in the bags? The hours researching mindfulness classes, signing up for them, going so far as parking outside the art gallery yoga studios and watching the well-intentioned students file in, only to lose my nerve and peel out? The hours planning to eat dinner as a family just to end up hunched in front of our screens, every man for himself? The hours steeped in shame that I had no excuse for any of it? And then, squeals. The first graders had burst onto the lawn wearing butterfly wings, shellacked with colorful bits of tissue paper. The young moms and the one dad turned their backs to me and basked in the slipstream of their children's spontaneity and delight. The energy in the room shifted from bubbly conviviality to hushed reverence. All the choices these young moms and the one dad had agonized over, to work or not work, to marry young or keep looking, to have a kid now or see the world first, had led to hard decisions. And with decisions come regrets, and sleepless nights, and recriminations, and fights with their husbands and the one wife, and whacked-out calls to the doctor for pills. The catatonic vision of frozen terror, the poet had called these moments of existential doubt or certainty, it was hard to know which, but seeing their children now in this instant, these parents knew in their teeth that their decisions had been the right ones. So, with a perfectly timed cough, I grabbed that young mom's ring of keys, dropped them in my purse, and slipped out. That's right. I stole them. Timby was lying on a cot in a corner of the office looking, to my trained eye, pretty darned pleased with himself. Get up, I said. I'm officially sick of this BS. On the downside, I'd said that. On the upside, it was so unnecessarily nasty that Lila and the other administrators pretended not to hear. Timby darkened and followed me out. I waited until we were standing at the car. We're going straight to the doctor's, and you'd better pray there's really something wrong with you. Can't we just go home? So you can drink ginger ale and watch Doctor Who? No! I refuse to reward you anymore for faking stomach aches. We're going to the doctor and straight back to school. I leaned in close, and for all I know, it's time for you to get a shot. You're mean! We got in the car. What's this? Timby asked with big eyes upon seeing the gift basket. Not for you. Don't get your paws near that thing. Timby was crying now. You're getting mad at me for being sick. We drove to the pediatricians in silence. Me angry at Timby. Me angry with myself for being angry at Timby. Me angry at Timby. Me angry with myself for being angry at Timby. His little voice. I love you, Mom. I love you, too. Timby, said the nurse. That's an unusual name. I was named by an iPhone, Timmy said around the thermometer in his mouth.
I named you, I said.
No,
Timmy glared. Yes, I glared back. When I was pregnant, we learned it was going to be a boy. Joe and I ecstatically volleyed names back and forth. One day, I texted Timothy, which autocorrected to Timby. How could we not? The nurse pulled out the thermometer. Normal. The doctor will be right in.
Nice work, I said after she left, making me look bad.
It's true, Timby said.
And why would an iPhone autocorrect a normal name to a name nobody's ever heard of?
It was a bug, I said. It was the first iPhone.
Oh, God, I just realized. I think I insulted Alonzo.
How? Timmy looked all sweet, but I knew he just wanted to lure me in for ammo to use against me.
Nothing, I said.
It was the look on Alonzo's face as I left the restaurant. Maybe he wasn't sad to see me go. Maybe he was insulted that I'd called him my poet.
Timmy hopped off the table and opened the door.
Where are you going? I asked.
To get a magazine.
The door slammed. My phone rang. Joyce Prim. As usual, 10:15 on the dot. I turned off the ringer and stared at the name. You know me from Looper Wash, and yes, I'm responsible for giving the show its retro-violent and sherbet-colored aesthetic. I'd long been obsessed with the outsider artist Henry Darger. Lucky me, I bought one of his paintings while they were still affordable. I'd even concede that in the pilot script, the four lead girls were flat on the page. It was only when I dressed them in 60s-style pinafores, gave them tangled hair, and just for fun, put them on board ponies that the writer, Violet Perry, understood what the show could be. She did a feverish rewrite and gave the girls nasty right-wing personalities, thus transforming them into the fabled Looper Four, who misdirected their unconscious fear of puberty into a random hatred of hippies, owners of purebred dogs, and babies named Steve. That said, Looper Wash wasn't mine. Nobody's ever heard of Eleanor Flood. I'd been semi-working, semi-broke, and living in New York. A children's catalog I'd illustrated caught the eye of Violet, who took a gutsy gamble and made me her animation director. The first thing I learned about TV, it's all about the deadlines. An episode not being ready for air? It could not happen, not even once. Settling for uninspired angles, hacky hand gestures, mismatched lip flap, wonky eyes, excessive cycling of backgrounds, signs misspelled by foreign animators, color errors? Oh, that happened plenty. But it would never occur to even the laziest, craziest animation director not to turn in the show on time. Publishing, on the other hand, while my name meant nothing, my style was instantly recognizable. And for a while, Looper Wash was everywhere. A rising star book editor named Joyce Prim, that's right, Joyce Prim, circling around, a method to the madness, had seen some drawings I'd done of my childhood and gave me an advance to expand them into a memoir. I'm a little past my deadline. For the longest time, I didn't hear a peep from Joyce. But here she was, calling me every day for the past week. My phone stopped ringing. Her voicemail joined the boneyard of other voicemails. Joyce Prim. Joyce Prim. Joyce Prim. Joyce Prim. Joyce Prim. All with little blue dots. None I dared listen to. Timby returned with a People magazine. On the cover, someone I didn't recognize, no doubt a reality TV star. They should rename it, Who Are These People? I said.
I've heard of him, Timby
said, hurt on behalf of the famous person. That's even more depressing, I said.
Knock, knock.
It was the pediatrician, Dr. Saba, her disposition even gentler than the nurse's. So, Timby, she said, disinfecting her hands, I hear you have a tummy ache. This is the third time in 2 weeks I've had to pick him. Let's hear it from Timby, the doctor said with a forgiving smile. Timby addressed the floor.
My stomach aches.
Is it all the time, Dr. Saba asked, or just sometimes?
Sometimes.
And you're in third grade?
Yes.
What school do you go to?
Gaylor Street.
Do you like it?
I guess.
Do you have friends?
I guess.
Do you like your teachers?
I guess.
Timby, Dr. Saba wheeled up on a stool. A lot of times when people get tummy aches, it's not because they have a bug, but because they have emotions that make them feel yucky. Timby's eyes remained down. I'm wondering if there's anything going on at school or at home that's making you feel yucky. Good luck with that, I thought. Timby, the king of the non-answer.
It's Piper Veal.
Who's Piper Veal? The doctor said.
A new girl in my class.
Piper's family was fresh from a year-long trip around the world. Is this not a rarefied but most annoying trend? Families traveling around the world to unplug and immerse themselves in foreign cultures, then parents frantically emailing you to please post comments on their kids' blogs so they won't think nobody gives a hoot. Come on, New York Times, do I have to come up with all your most emailed articles? What's Piper doing? Asked Dr. Saba.
She's bullying me,
Timby said, his voice cracking. My life zoomed into awful focus. Here, now, Timby. The gentleness, the celebrity gossip, the over-identification with Gaston from Beauty and the Beast. Was Timby gay? It had certainly occurred to me, but there was also the snap circuits, Mythbusters, the obsession with escalators. Of course, the smoking gun would be the flirtation with makeup, but that was his Pavlovian response to being loved up by a harem of Nordstrom hotties. If anything, it proved Timby was all man. A mother knows. Or, in my case, a mother will love him regardless and let it play out the way it's going to play out. Which is more than I can say for Gaylor Street. Our very first interview, we'd come straight from Nordstrom, where the girls had adorned Timby with a beauty mark and very subtle mascara, darling. As soon as we walked in the conference room, I could practically hear the admissions director shouting, Eureka! We've got a transgender! Joe and I joked about it later that night. After we'd been accepted and without telling us, the school had taken it upon themselves to switch all the boys' and girls' bathrooms to gender-neutral. I hope you didn't do this for Timby, I said to the head of the school, Gwen.
Oh, no, she said. We did it for all our little genderqueers.
To that, there could be only one response. To laugh my ass off. But I had the good sense to wait until I got outside. Was I in denial? Had I become lulled into complacency as a reaction against Gaylor Street's fervent embrace of everything? And just because the administrators were so tolerant of the occasional pink thumbnail, the same might not be said for the kids on the playground. Have you told your mom about Piper? Asked Dr. Saba.
No,
Timby said. Dr. Saba didn't have to shoot me a disappointed look. I could feel it beaming through the back of her skull. Have you told your teachers?
No.
What kind of things is Piper doing to you?
I don't know,
Timby said. Is she hurting your body? Dr. Saba asked.
No,
Timby said, his mouth full of saliva. What did Piper do? I twisted in my chair and held my breath.
She told me I bought my shirt at H&M.
Oh. You bought your shirt at H&M? Repeated the doctor. When Piper was in Bangladesh, she went on a tour of a factory with child slaves, and they were making clothes for H&M. I see, said Dr. Saba. Timby, third grade is when things start to get complicated with your friends. Sometimes your feelings can get so big they cause a tummy ache. Timby finally looked up and into Dr. Saba's eyes. Do you know the best medicine for that? She asked.
What?
Talk to your grown-up, Dr. Saba said. Your mom. But if it's not your mom, it is his mom, I said. Talk to your dad, your grandma, your favorite teacher. Tell them how you're feeling. They might not be able to fix it, but sometimes just talking is enough.
Timby smiled.
You look like you're feeling better already.
I am.
That's what I like to hear, she said, standing.
Good, I said. We can go back to school.
Timby hopped off the table and pulled open the door.
Hey, where's he going?
I asked. The door shut.
It was just me, Dr. Saba, and the mural of zombie-eyed lemurs.
Do you have to go right back to work? Dr. Saba asked. Because what Timby really needs is mommy time.
I'll move some stuff around.
Dr. Saba stood there, calling my bluff. I dialed Sydney Madsen and got voicemail.
Sydney, I have to reschedule. Something came up with Timby.
Dr. Saba gave me a nod and headed out.
Timby was at the nurse's station, whistling as he ferreted through a cardboard box covered with wrapping paper. A nurse asked,
Do you want a wash your hands pencil or a good job tattoo?
Can I have both?
Timby said, still scrounging.
Ooh, is this gum?
He picked up a box but dropped it instantly when it turned out to be chalk. That was it. Timby was going back to school, and I was going to get this Sydney Madsen lunch behind me. The last thing I needed was a fresh round of passive-aggressive subject lines. Remember me? Hello, stranger. Lunch with a friend. So needy. As far as I'm concerned, the only thing sweeter than seeing a friend is that friend canceling on me. I dialed Sydney's number. Hi, forget my last message. I'll see you at noon. Somehow Dr. Saba was standing there. Some other day, just making sure you got the message.
Am I going back to school or not?
Timby asked. The spotlight was on me.
We're going to have some mommy time, I said.
Mommy time?
He said, not unafraid.
We left Dr. Saba's office and stepped onto the streets of downtown, my mind a muddle. What I needed now was Joe. Joe could cut through my confusion. Joe the sword. There's a phenomenon I call the helpless traveler. If you're traveling with someone who's confident, organized, and decisive, you become the helpless traveler. Are we there yet? My bags are too heavy. My feet are getting blisters. This isn't what I ordered. We've all been that person. But if the person you're traveling with is helpless, then you become the one able to decipher train schedules, spend 5 hours walking on marble museum floors without a complaint, order fearlessly from foreign menus, and haggle with crooked cab drivers. Every person has it in him to be either the competent traveler or the helpless traveler. Because Joe is so clear-headed and sharp, I've been able to go through life as the helpless traveler, which, now that I think about it, might not be such a good thing. It's a question for Joe. His office was a few blocks away. Even just seeing him through the glass would be enough to center me.
Wait, Timby said. We're going to Dad's? Can I play with the iPad?
Joe and I were waging the altogether futile war against electronics by not letting Timby play video games. The one loophole was the iPads in Joe's office.
Is that something you'd like to do?
I asked Timby in an unexpected sing-song like a stranger offering candy.
I could drop you off while I popped over to lunch.
Whoa,
he said, processing his unbelievably good fortune.
Yeah!
I called Sydney yet again.
Guess who? Disregard my messages. I'll see you at noon.
Hey, look!
Timby had spotted the sign for Jazz Alley.
It's that place with the oily hummus, and they make ginger ale by combining Coke and Sprite, and you have to sit at tiny tables smooshed together with people you don't know.
Perhaps I complained more than once about being dragged there by jazz-loving Joe. If you were ever driven to the brink of madness listening to Rush's Tom Sawyer, try sitting through an Argo jazz trio doing a baffling 45-minute version.
Not a fan of jazz, I said to Timby. No woman is.
You should tell Dad to go by himself, he said.
Don't think I haven't tried, I said. But there's something about me the guy can't quit.
We shared a shrug and headed to Joe's office.
The first thing that should have tripped my alarm was the empty waiting room. But this wasn't completely unprecedented. Joe had celebrity clients, athletes and musicians who, for a variety of reasons, ego, couldn't be in the same waiting room as civilians. Therefore, down the hall from the double-doored entrance to the Wallace Surgery Center was a row of single, unmarked private waiting rooms. Conceivably, Joe's patients could have been